You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Daryl Davis is an activist working hard to build bridges between people with radically different points of view. Jeff Skoop was, for 25 years, the leader of the National Socialist Movement, the American Nazi Party. Today, he works to help members of hate groups find their ways out. How did you guys meet? How'd that happen?
Okay, well, a documentary was being made on the work that I do.
Oh, that's right.
And it's called Accidental Courtesy. So anyway, yeah. So the producer and director were flying me around the country, and I was, you know, meeting with different KKK people and interviewing them, a chapter of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And Jeff, who represented the National Socialist Movement, the largest neo-Nazi organization in the country, was invited to be interviewed by me. I did not know Jeff personally. I knew who he was. I knew what he stood for. I'd seen him on TV. I'd read about him, et cetera. And so the game plan was, we were in Alabama at the time, and he was invited to come to Montgomery, Alabama, where this meeting was to take place. And I drove over to the spot from the hotel, and as I was parking, I saw Jeff and sitting with a young lady on a bench right outside the grill place. And we had a good conversation. There were some things he said that I agreed with, other things he said that I did not agree with, but we laughed and joked about some things. And I can tell you, you know, when I met Jeff, I shook hands with a stranger. But despite who he was and his views, when I left, I shook hands with what I believed was a friend.
Michael Abels, Golden Globe nominated and award-winning composer, is comfortable working in so many different musical genres. Here, Michael speaks of his desire to compose, even as a very young child. And I have the great pleasure today of speaking with Michael Abels, who is Truth in Advertising, someone I've known for many years. He may not want to take credit for this, but when I learned piano from him, then I stopped learning piano, and then I forgot, and I unlearned piano. But he is just, yeah, exactly.
That's very close. So I was actually born in Phoenix, but quickly imported to South Dakota, where my grandparents were raising me until about age 7. Uh-huh. And then I went back to Phoenix, who was raised by my aunt and uncle there until I went to, I'm an Arizona native, even though I was in South Dakota as a very young child. And then I always thought, the very first time I was in LA, I thought, this is where I should live. And I was about 9 or 10.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. How I've gone to the places I've been has always seemed very much like it's made sense to me. So I went to USC majored in music, been here ever since.
Yeah. Okay. So when did music, when did music enter your life? Now I know that's music is somehow in almost every, it's hard to imagine music not being in one way or another in everyone's life. But when did it enter your life in a way where you felt so drawn to it that, you know, you kept following that muse?
Some of my earliest memories are of music. I mean, I have a memory that I believe was before I could walk. And I even remember, I then learned the name of the piece when that music recurred, and I was able to understand. Like the piece is called In the Hall of the Mountain King by Edvard Grieg. I remember hearing that, I think before I could walk, and I don't know why. And, you know, when you have a memory that seems like it's from that early an age, you have to question if it was
true.
But I have other memories of, you know, of The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins were probably the first couple of movies I ever saw. And just the music just grabbed a hold of me. And
were your grandparents or your aunt and uncle sort of musical people? Like, did they play instruments? Was there music all over the house? Could you just like reach your hand out and grab some string thing?
They weren't musicians, but they were, here's what they were. So in every farmhouse in South Dakota at that time that I remember, there, you know, in the living room, there was a television and there was a sofa. There was also a spinet piano. Yeah. And so the message I got was that, you know, people in their active, they sit on couches, they watch television, they play pianos. I just assumed that everybody could play the piano. I assumed that I myself could play the piano. And
I assumed that too. And you know how that
Yes. our assumptions are always, you know. But then what I wanted to do is I wanted to play Do Re Mi from The Sound of Music because I love that song.
Ah, sure.
And I thought, well, I'll just play that. And somehow my version of it left something to be desired compared to the version, the Oscar, the Rodgers and Hammerstein version. So I asked my grandmother, why doesn't this sound right? You know, I was 4 years old, but I was just like, what's the problem here? And she said, well, you have to take piano lessons. And I'm like, well, sign me up. That seemed like the most I had to be able to play that. It was just necessary. And, you know, I mean, you could say that that's an odd feeling for a four-year-old to have, but to me it felt utterly like I have to play the song. It's very important, and if it takes practice, then I'm down.
And then Krista Bilton's Normal Family is a fascinating memoir about her effort to make sense of her discovery that her father was in fact a sperm donor, perhaps one of the most prolific sperm donors in California. Normal Family could easily have been a bizarre tale of secrets and lies. It is instead ultimately a story of love. And in some ways, I ended up reading it both as a story about you and a story about your family and a story about your mom. Me too. I'm tearing up too.
This is
not supposed to happen.
I never do this in podcasts.
Well, there you go.
Note to self, don't do a podcast with someone you know personally.
But ultimately, it really was a story about love and family. And so you took me to all those places.
That I found out in my mid-20s that the man I had known as my dad, after I was born, secretly became one of the most prolific sperm donors of the California Cryobank Bank, and that I had anywhere between several dozen and possibly hundreds of half-siblings growing up all over the U.S. So that's sort of the jumping off point. And the book opens with me sort of after 10 years from learning about that and not wanting anything to do with these siblings, 10 years later to inviting a bunch of them that I had never met to my home. And so that's sort of where the book opens. And then I take you back to how we got there. But really it's the story of me growing up with my incredibly unconventional mom and dad in the 80s, 90s, Los Angeles.
Well, maybe it's because I knew you and your mom, right? But I felt like the book, intentional or otherwise, did such a magnificent job of calling that out, of making that really crystal clear. Like, you have no idea. One has no idea what someone else is going through. The judgments we make about anybody, right? About like the God, what an asshole. Yeah, that may be. That person may be an asshole, but boy, we don't understand. We don't know. We can find out and then decide, yeah, that person's really just a thoroughgoing asshole. Or we might, as you did in the book, or at least what I got from it was, we might say, wow, I had no idea. Of course, that's why, blah, blah, blah.
You hit the nail on the head. You just never know what someone's going through and what their private struggles are. And even your own family, like I.
6 months since becoming the mayor of the city of Los Angeles, Karen Bass generously took time to speak to me of her time in her new role and her efforts to tackle the challenges of homelessness and crime in the City of Angels. And today I am delighted to be speaking, well, to be speaking to the mayor of Los Angeles, but I know her as my good friend, Karen Bass.
That's so, right.
And she is the mayor of Los Angeles.
So that's right.
Don't be fooled into thinking she is just my good friend.
So friendship is first and most important.
Thank you. And I agree with that, right? I feel no different about you, except I'm just happier that you are the mayor. So,
yeah.
So, now we've been speaking about COVID. Karen has, at the moment, has tested positive for COVID, and now I've got my voice is going. So I don't know why.
It's contagious.
Oh my God! Even over Zoom. Have there been any surprises when you walked in the door? You know, once you were able to kind of look under the carpet, and are there things that there must be? It's a city.
Yes,
there are things that must come up. And
well, there's things that have shocked me when it comes to homelessness. The fact that the level of bureaucracy and the insanity of it, considering that we have 40,000 people asleep on the street. Let me give you an example. This is the best example. You're living in a tent, David. You've been living there for 5 years. Well, in order to get housing, you have to prove to me that you're poor. And by the way, where's your ID?
Yes, the ID problem is huge.
You don't have it? Oh, okay. Well, listen, let me help you fill out the paperwork so you can get your ID. Now you ask me, where's it going to be mailed? To my tent?
Right.
So what I don't understand is that why are we putting people through this stuff? Why don't I put you in a motel room? And why don't I assume that you're poor?
It's one of those, yes, it's one of those when you hear about it, you're just like, duh.
Right.
Yeah, it's wild.
But that's the kind of thing that has just shocked me, considering the magnitude of the problem here. If there were 10 or 15 people on the street, okay, so there's bureaucracy. But why didn't the city and the county act with a sense of urgency? There was no urgency.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you that question. I mean, without mentioning anybody's name, of course, but well, unless you want to. But that's a good question. Why, given the size of the problem, Why has the bureaucracy made it all but impossible to address these human beings like they're human beings?
Well, this is a functional problem of our system. When policies are passed, unless there is a specific sunset, they last forever. And so when you pile policy on policy on policy with no sunset, you have a mess. And you have all of these people who are trying to do the right thing by following the policies that actually contradict each other. And so you don't have a lot of people who are willing to say, you know what, I'm not going to follow that rule because it makes no sense. People don't want to jeopardize their careers. Politicians don't want to take a risk because they might fail. And I've had people who are in office today who, when I started this, said, you tell me you're going to deal with the encampments? I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Well, it's like, you're saying you wouldn't touch 40,000 people sleeping outside with a 10-foot pole? Well, no, because, I mean, I don't know what to do. They're risk averse. And look, I might fail. But you know what? I'm going to go down trying.
Yeah. Northwestern University computer science professor Larry Birnbaum takes the time to speak about artificial intelligence, large language models, and ChatGPT in particular. Is it a great advance in human achievement, or a reason to wake up in the middle of the night, frightened that machines will render human beings irrelevant? How should people who have no idea what you're talking about feel about
it? I don't know how I feel about it, David. So you're asking.
There we go. That's the last question.
You know, look. Look. What do I think? I think it's a great triumph, and I think it is not the end of the line for AI. There's a lot of stuff that, again, we don't understand. So these machines, for example, there are certain fundamental things that they don't have. These kind of LLMs. They don't really have goals. When they're saying something to you, it's not because they want you to know something. You know, I mean, they don't seem to go through the process that we go through in producing intentional or goal-directed behavior. I mean, there's no gainsaying the incredible advances. Now, I want to say something about this, by the way. I still haven't talked about how neural networks get applied to, or deep learning gets applied to, language, and I'll just say that very quickly.
Yeah, please.
All that these large language models that they're called LLMs or neural language models do, they have one task, which is to predict the next word. So what you do is you basically say, I need some milk. I'm going to go to the, what are you going to say?
Not cow. I'm going to go to the store.
I'm going to go to the store. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Okay. So it's an obvious prediction. And so what we want is for the machine to be able to make that prediction, given that context, predict the word store, or maybe the phrase grocery store or something like that.
Okay? Right.
Or maybe the name of a particular grocery store. So that's what you're going to predict. And you know, they have this on your cell phone already, right? When you're trying to text people.
Autocorrect, absolutely.
Or the thing that helps predict so that you don't have to actually type the whole word. It says maybe you want to say, tomorrow, you know, or something like that.
The thing that, so the thing gathering, that screws up my text messages all the time, right?
Yeah, it's right. It's gathering statistics about the frequency with which certain words follow other sequences of words. Okay. And that's what these systems are doing. Mm-hmm. They're you take a neural network and you put it in a paradigm where it's going to take the end preceding words and proceed and then be able to predict the next word. Okay. Or actually what it does is compute a probability distribution over all the words of the likelihood that word is going to show up, okay? And then when you take a thing like ChatGPT or any neural language model, when it's going to be used for the generation mode, that's why it's called a language model. It's a model of the statistical likelihood of words following other words in the language, okay? Now, you might say to yourself, gee, there seems to be a lot more going on in language than just predicting the next word, and you'd probably be right. But it turns out that you can do a heck of a lot with this if you have a big enough memory and enough.
Marianne Williamson is running as a Democratic candidate for the presidency of the United States in the 2024 election. Marianne speaks candidly about the problems with the current political systems and what the next president must do to set a course for a better, more equitable, and more sustainable world.
What we have is a matrix of corporate power that is really a reversion. It's a psychological as well as political reversion to what is basically an aristocratic system. This is what theoretically we repudiated in 1776, right? It used to be landed gentry. Today, it's corporate entities. So it's insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and big agricultural companies and big food companies and big chemical companies and gun manufacturers and big oil and defense contractors. And the way our government operates, more than not, one party much worse than the other. No doubt about that. Republicans much worse than Democrats. But that can't be our excuse forever. So I don't know what these people are so proud of. Now, this is the thing. This country is different than it was before the last election. In the last election, what I found, you know, running and talking to voters, you know, who would be voting in the Democratic primary, people had an understandable focus on, let's just get rid of Donald Trump. I just want to get rid of Donald Trump. What we have found since then, much to the dismay of many of us, obviously, is that it was more like a tumor that in fact had already metastasized. So just getting rid of the tumor did not get rid of the cancer of hatred and the plague of mean-spiritedness that he had in many ways harnessed. Now, people, what I find, because my campaign is already on a roll, you know, we're already out there, I'm talking to people. People are more open now to the realization that something deeper is wrong. than can be dealt with by simply some transactional old-fashioned conversation, particularly Gen Z, David. They're not even 20th century people. They don't feel that they should have to live their lives at the effect of bad ideas left over from the 20th century. And they don't talk like people stuck in the 20th century. They have a more holistic, whole person perspective on life. And so they don't find it weird when a politician does. They find it weird when a politician doesn't. And that's who has us like blowing up on TikTok and all of that stuff.
And do you feel like you're, well, obviously nobody's getting enough, but do you feel like you're getting enough exposure?
Well, I mean, the mainstream media.
Your days are probably really long, but. Yeah.
The mainstream media is seeking to invisibilize me.
Yes,
I mean, it's, right. It's ridiculous, but independent media, and I tell you, TikTok and all of that, I mean, it's, that's where, you know, the kids are all right.
Yeah.
TikTok has its own issues, of course, but
so I have a question for you that, you know, I don't know if it seems weird or not, but who inspires you? Like, who do you look at that is inspiring or somebody you admire? I don't mean, whatever language that is that one uses.
Well, on a political level, Bernie Sanders, of course.
Yeah.
In terms of my life, my father and my mother, but my father was. My father was really something. He was like a cross between William Kunstler and Zorba the Greek. And
That's big.
My
That's
father big. Was something else. You would love my father. So my father used to walk around the house when we were kids. Beat the system, kids. Beat the system, kids.
Ara Sunada Newland is the executive director of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. Heart Mountain is the site of one of 10 concentration camps established during World War II, where thousands of people of Japanese descent were incarcerated simply because of their heritage and ethnicity. The Foundation's work is a powerful voice in the effort to keep the truth about this shameful moment in American history alive, in hopes that nothing like it will ever happen again.
Heart Mountain is one of 10 main camps in the country, and it was named the Heart Mountain Relocation Center. But relocation kind of sounds like, oh, we just moved our house.
Wyoming is a pretty place.
Right. It doesn't really capture that people were taken from their homes, forced out of their homes, allowed to bring only what they could carry in their, you know, suitcases, put on a train to an unknown place and locked up behind barbed wire with guard towers and guns pointing inward at them for an indefinite amount of time with a completely uncertain future. Well, yeah, life at Heart Mountain, as you said, it wasn't a dungeon. In fact, it was a hastily built city that at any given point had about 10,000 people living there, and that made it the third largest city in Wyoming at the time. Definitely, you know, kind of barren and cold and windswept. The camps were, the sites for these camps were selected on the basis of, you know, is there a large empty space where you could just like pop up a town? It had to be near a railroad so people could get there. And they also wanted areas that could be farmed. And so ultimately, one of the early hardships of life at Heart Mountain, and ultimately one of the triumphs of life at Heart Mountain, was the farming program, wherein incarcerees transformed the landscape, grew an amazing array of crops, finished digging the irrigation canal that is still in use by farmers today in that area, that had converted it from this like kind of barren high plains area into a lush, you know, highly productive farmland. So it was, I mean, people lived in barracks that had really no insulation at first. They were crowded. They were surrounded by barbed wire. And again, guard towers with guns pointed inward. People were able to move around freely within the camp. They could, you know, get permission to leave camp. Ultimately, through a really kind of convoluted process, people got permission to leave, not just for work, but to leave and go to college, or to leave and go serve in the military, or even be drafted into the military. But they were not free. Right. Every movement they made needed to be like checked through the administration. And so some of the pushback that we get from the folks who remember the war years locally, and this was kind of fed to people by local newspapers as well, which was like, well, sure, the food in camp was bad, but everybody, you know, everybody was experiencing food rationing. Everybody was cold. Nobody had money. At least you guys had like indoor toilets, and at least you were being provided food. How come it's, you know, why are people upset about this? But the distinction of not being free is a powerful one. And the fact that they were being held, you know, indefinitely with no future in sight, not knowing when it would end, and having to give up everything that they had built their lives around before that, is an incredibly traumatic and damaging thing to do.
Robert Oakes is the former chief of probation of Sonoma County, California. Here, Oakes speaks candidly about finding the delicate balance between punishment and care that best serves the community, law enforcement institutions, and those convicted of criminal behavior.
But there are some kids that are so damaged, so dangerous, have such great needs. We don't have those resources, especially if you think about, well, think about sex offenders, you think about arsonists, you think about mentally ill kids, or you know, somebody committed a double homicide. You're going to keep them locally, you keep locally, you know, in the community for 10 years, 15 years. So the chief, probation chief, wanted the state to keep it open for just this, you know, the small number, for the very difficult ones. And Newsom said, no, we're shutting it down. So
wait, you need to say that again, just because it is so not the message that gets played in the middle. We are in the middle of, or in some point in a massive reduction of crime.
Yes. And you might remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when there was a federal crime bill, there was talk about the super predators, juveniles coming up, and we have to make all these laws, and we have to build these prisons, and we have to just get rid of them. And as a matter of fact, at that point, there was an important piece of research, probably 70s or 80s, this sociologist who did some research way before that stuff that I told you, what we know that works.
Yeah.
Some piece of research, he said, well, we've looked at all the different ways we've tried to help offenders, and you know what? Nothing works. Nothing works. We can't help them. So, and though that was consistent with the thinking at the time, which was lock them up, throw away the key.
Right.
And over time, research was saying, you know what? That's not right. Some things do work. Some things do work. And more research over time was showing some of the things I talked about. But at the same time, crime was high. People were feeling punitive. But then it's been dropping for decades. And criminologists have not been able to fully explain why. Some of it is better policing. Some of it is more and more research known on what works, you know, upstream kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The last few years, we're seeing change. And it's really easy to mess with, lie with statistics, as you know. We had an old book,
sure.
Lie with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, but we want, you say, well, you know, we don't like this liberal DA, so we're going to show you what the crime stats are. And all that is distorted, you know, and it really not easy. That out, but the long-term trend is, it was down.
Wow. Although the name Layla Steinberg may not be widely known, the names of some of the young people she mentors are: educator, manager, and mentor to some of the most well-known rap artists in the world, among them Tupac Shakur and Tebe Kozitsile, also known as Earl Sweatshirt. Layla speaks of her attempt to keep community justice and love at the center of the rap industry.
But just in terms of how I'm referred to in public spaces and the fact that I haven't done a new bio or really anything in years, I definitely get tied into my 20s and my entry into the business of music. So when people think about whether I've contributed or not, I'm definitely connected to Tupac. He's been part of my identity. It was a train that got away from all of us, and it was
What does that mean? Wait a second. I think I'm frozen. So let me unfreeze. There we go. So what does that mean? There was a train that got away from.
It means he started out. If we look at Malcolm X and we look at just his transformation and who he was as an activist that woke up a generation and became the symbol of a level of activism. Tupac was a lot like Malcolm in the beginning. He wanted to fight for a cause. He wanted social justice. He wanted things different for the Black community primarily, but he cared about humanity. When he died, his lifestyle was really toxic. He had people around him that were toxic. His behavior changed. I still love Pac, but if we're honest, he wasn't healthy for the Black community in the end of his life. Those 9 months that he was on Suge's label, he was really divided. He really wanted to make a difference, but he was living a lifestyle that informed by hip hop culture, rap music, and this is part of this Kanye conversation. Record executives profited off of violence, perpetuating some really unhealthy things. And I watched it and was not able to impact anything. I was not respected enough. I was really convenient when I brought incredible talent to the table, when I developed talent. But as a woman in business, I had a lot of fights in a lot of rooms. And I really saw how unhealthy this industry was for Tupac and what it did to him. And so with Tebe, I saw an opportunity to have an influence. And he was young enough, and my voice was so much stronger, that I wanted to see this really brilliant young man live. And
Doctors Peter Schnall and Marnie Dobson, direct and co-direct the Center for Social Epidemiology. Their research in the area of work stress and the damage it does to workers, their families, and the organizations they work for sheds light on the problems of worker stress and what can be done to fix them.
Okay, so my blood pressure went up, okay, before I even started driving the bus. When I killed my first pedestrian, okay, and they said, okay, that's it, you can't drive this bus anymore. Okay. Killing pedestrians is not allowed, even when you're behind the wheel of an automated
make-believe bus.
Okay. But what is invisible to even the people who are working in these jobs? I mean, it's an incredible problem to educate our society to what work is doing to people in our modern society, when the workers themselves, okay, who are experiencing these stressors, are unaware of the fact that they are being damaged by this, okay? There's a reason why they call high blood pressure the silent killer.
Sure.
People work for years on a job, their blood pressures, we have epidemiologic studies. We see that the overall population blood pressure goes up roughly 1 millimeter per year that you work in the workplace. You enter the workplace at 120 over 80 at the age of 20, and you leave the workplace at 60 at roughly 140 over 90. So that's been explained by medical science. Oh, this is aging. The problem with that conclusion is it's not true. There are many groups within American society whose blood pressures don't go up inevitably with age, whose blood pressures are pretty much the same at the age of 60 or 80 as they were when they were 20 or 30. And non-industrial cultures all over the world don't show increases of blood pressure with age. Agricultural workers, Swinton/Slashburn, ergonomic workers, they are all groups of people whose blood pressures basically stay pretty much steady their whole lives.
Until he left the organization in 2019, Jeff Scoop was for 25 years the leader of the National Socialist Movement, the largest and most active neo-Nazi organization in the United States. Now, as the founder and president of Beyond Barriers, Jeff works tirelessly to help people avoid being drawn into extremist groups and ideologies. It's a powerful thing, and I'm really grateful that you're willing to, that you're doing the work you're doing now, and that you're and that you're no longer doing what you were doing, and that you're willing to speak about it and be honest about it and be upfront about it. Was it a struggle? Is it a struggle for you to have come to the realization of what you were doing in the world and forgiving yourself for doing that?
It certainly was a struggle. I still struggle with the word forgiveness, because a lot of times when I look back on my life and the things that I've was involved in and stuff, it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult word, I guess you could say, to contend with. I'd like to say that I've forgiven myself, and I think that the work I'm doing now speaks for itself and is redemptive working towards reconciliation and all of those things. So I think that's important as well. But I still struggle with that word, because there's people out there in the world that I've met countless people. I couldn't even give you a number that have said, you know, that they've forgiven me, and I've apologized to some of the people that I was nasty to in my previous I like to say previous life. It was the same life, but you know,
yes, right,
yes. Yeah. I like to look at it as if it was somebody else, but you know, so I've made a lot of positive strides in that, one of my friends, an African American man, you know, he told me, and he was at one of my talks, and he said, he grabs me afterwards, you know, when there was no one there, and he says, you better not ever say that you don't forgive yourself, Jeff. This, like, that's going to hold you back. You know, you're doing good things, you know, don't struggle with that. But I try to remember that when people ask, because it's tough, yeah. You know, like I take ownership for what I've done in my past, you know, and I think that's an important part, yeah, towards that. But not everybody can forgive, and I understand that too. Yeah.
Award-winning musical composer Michael Abels returns to Curiosity Invited on the occasion of his winning the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for Music for the opera Omar. Michael speaks about winning this prestigious award along with his co-author, Rhiannon Giddens, as well as his newfound and well-deserved notoriety.
I'll never forget my first award show when it ended. And I'd never done this before, you know, and I went downstairs. There was a fleet of, I don't know how many, but let's easily 100 black, you know, SUV Suburbans in the belly of this giant, you know, hotel, all there to pick up people who had been at the party. They were all there simultaneously. And each one, the only way you could tell them apart was by each one had a number on their windshield. And you had to hope that you had remembered the number of your car, because if you had not, you were sunk.
Suddenly you'd end up in a mansion in Bel Air.
Does this piece work? And I had always had a sense about, especially as we refined it, like we got to where I felt like every part of it, I could say, this works. This does exactly what it needs to do. But there's nothing like feeling that and then feeling that in an audience full of people. It's just, but because you've spent so many years hoping that that might be the possibility, when it proves true, it's just, it's beyond words to explain what that's like.
Well, it's from this side, watching it happen out there, it's just so splendid, and I'm so happy. And then, in certain ways, it seemed like the Pulitzer was icing on the cake. And well, of course it would. What are you talking about? Well, you've been, since last time we spoke, you've been stocking up on awards. And it was that question that, you know, that is there, how does one fit all that into a life and still allow the muse to come visit?
Well, you have to work, you have to struggle to balance those things, and it's challenging.
I'll bet it's challenging.
And there are periods of time, sometimes weeks of time, which are given up to, you know, the extrovert side of what that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And responding to the world that whose attention you have struggled to get. And then you've got it and you discover that.
I didn't mean that. That's not what I meant.
No.
Do that over there.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, you have that as your next level of how do I manage this? You know, but it's a blessing to have a problem like that. So yes.
Thanks so much for listening to and viewing the best of 2023 of Curiosity Invited.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.